Hello, and thank you for tuning in to The Seneca Scene, a podcast from The Herald, the campus newspaper of Hobart and William Smith Colleges. For the next few weeks, we are doing something different. Instead of focusing on people around campus, we are turning back the clocks and examining a fascinating part of our history. During the late 1960s, a time of activism, political turmoil, and social change, the campus of Hobart and William Smith Colleges was irrevocably altered. We will be focusing on the events leading up to 1970, when it was discovered that a man who had been seen as a radical was actually an undercover police officer. This man is known as Tommy the Traveler, and his tale has been retold for decades with legends, such as the firebombing of Cheryl Hall, existing to this day. In this 10-episode series, you will be hearing from a range of voices, including faculty, alums, and community members, who were all here at Hobart and William Smith Colleges and in Geneva for Tommy the Traveler. In addition to those interviews, we also have been combing through the archives looking at documents and newspaper articles from the time. Two of our writers and researchers will be in the studio with us talking about their work throughout the duration of this series. We hope that you will join us on this journey and are looking forward to sharing the story with you. I'm Alex Karai.
I'm Henry Dewar.
I'm Russell Payne.
And this is the Seneca Scene special series on Tommy the Traveler. Episode 10, The End. The following episode discusses civil unrest in the 1960s on a college campus and has language, content, and themes that may be unsettling for some listeners. Listener discretion is advised. So, what have been your takeaways? You know, we've been working on this podcast series for months now, and we've been talking about it. We're on episode 10. We've done hours of discussion on Tommy the Traveler and his time on campus. What is your takeaway from all of this, you guys?
I mean, for me, it feeds into my narrative that, and one of my great overarching theses is that everyone is just kids. And at one point, we stop looking like kids, but we're still just like fumbling around. And I think the way that everything was handled on the law enforcement side in this case, and you know, with Tommy in particular, is really indicative of that. Like, it's just so bad.
I mean, I'd say quite the opposite. I think this is spectacular. I wouldn't say the overall events were a good thing, but the takeaway for me is that activism used to mean something on this campus, to the point where the federal government felt threatened enough to send us this guy. So if that was our collective power back in the day, I can only just like smile to think of what we could do as a student body, as two colleges, as a community, both internally and externally, because I think we live in times that are just as turbulent, you know. I listened to a lot of interviews where people said I really wouldn't understand what it was like to have all this uncertainty and, you know, knowledge and fear of the war going on and the world at large. And I can certainly say that I'm free of the draft, but I can relate to that angst and that desire to make something more out of my daily life. And I think that as a campus, we can kind of take a view of this and say, okay, we used to do things here.
Yeah, I think that's really important to look at. And to say, you know, this campus was very active. This was a place of great change. We've been talking to a lot of people throughout this show. We've talked to over 20 people. And they all discuss how much campus changed in about a 6 to 8 year period. Basically, like 66 to 74. And it's fascinating to see how much changed in that time period and how a lot of it was dictated by the circumstances.
Best of times, worst of times. I mean, it was absolutely a privilege to be there at the time. You know, it was, and to be part of that little niche in history, because when we came in 1967, we had freshman beanies, which we were supposed to wear till the football team first scored. My sister went to Smith, not William Smith, and was 2 years ahead of me, and I had gone there to visit, and it was like stepping into an F. Scott Fitzgerald novel. So we were, and all of that was gone in 1968. So we got to see a period of incredible transition. That, you know, people think of the 60s as being starting in, you know, 1963 or something with the Beatles. On the East Coast, you know, the 60s, as it's thought of probably by people of your generation, didn't really start till 67, 68, you know, except for, you know, little pockets in New York City or whatever. But, you know, it was, so what I'm saying is it was very, very momentous period of change and how things were going on. And that period, 1970, with Kent State and just the upheaval, and, you know, we were all facing the draft and the draft lottery, I think, had just been done. It was a tumultuous time. And having said that, it was also a great time of extremes. You know, we had a wonderful standard of living. We enjoyed ourselves. We had wonderful music and friends and, you know, freedom and opportunities that people before us, just a few years, didn't have.
Back then, when I was a senior, there was a gym requirement. You couldn't graduate unless you fulfilled the athletic requirement. You could either be on a team or you had to take gym classes. So two of my friends and I had just kind of put off the gym requirement, and it was his senior year. And one of the gym requirements you could do was to play golf at the Geneva Country Club, which was down the street a ways. So we said, yeah, let's bring our clubs up, and we'll play a little golf in the spring, and we'll fulfill our requirement. But the Geneva Country Club, upon hearing this, didn't want any long-haired hippies playing golf on their course, and they refused to let us in. And so we went to the dean and said, look, we want to graduate. This is our, it says right here in the handbook we can play golf as to meet a requirement. And the result was they canceled the gym requirement then and forever because we couldn't play golf at the Geneva Country Club because our hair was too long.
Well, I think it was an enormous time of change. Those 4 years culminating, I think, in 1970. And I think there were sea changes at the colleges, and I would describe Tommy the Traveler as a wave in a sea of change. He was not by any means the core change agent. And I think he more floated along and tried to exploit changes that came from the country at large and from, you know, within the student body. So I described the changes in dormitory living. And that endured for a couple of years. At one point, there were, within a couple of years of 1970, there were mixed floors with shared bathrooms. Men and women shared showers and bathrooms. That was a big change. There were students on faculty committees. I served on the Academic Affairs Committee. There were drastic revolutions in curriculum at that time, which continued on for years. So there was really global change was going on. And I would regard Tommy the Traveler as perhaps the most famous individual but not by any means the most important change agent.
That was Bill Ryder, Bill Banker, and Richard Wasserman talking about some of the changes on campus during this time. There were also massive changes in society as we look beyond campus. Here are Richard Wasserman, Andy Wickenden, and Bill Ryder to discuss more. Andy wrote the article, The Radical Who Wasn't, for the Hobart and William Smith publication, The Pulteney Street Survey.
Things were kind of moving out of the hippie flower power era. And 1968 and 69 were pretty dark years nationally. A lot of political protests that kind of devolved into violence. The Vietnam War, obviously. But I feel like a lot of the optimism maybe of the mid 60s kind of came up against some of this violence. And talking to a lot of the people for the article, that certainly carried through the sense of optimism and purpose and responsibility and engagement, but maybe perhaps not through such rose-colored glasses. There was clearly a very concrete danger on the flip side of the coin, perhaps embodied by everything that happened around Tommy the Traveler. I think maybe another thing was a strong sense of questioning of authority, and maybe that sort of ties back into some of the changes in the curriculum and the pushback against the administration at the time. But from everything that I read, there was a lot of involvement on the side of the sheriff's department and the FBI, and sort of, I guess we zoom back a little farther. This was kind of stuff that was happening all over the country at the time. This wasn't an isolated incident where you had elements of the government at best kind of infiltrating and keeping tabs on some of the student movements, and at worst kind of fomenting violence as we see here. So I think this incident really raised people's consciousnesses and made them skeptical and if not distrustful, certainly wary of institutional authority and not shy about questioning it.
Well, there were larger changes in society going on. It was the middle of the sexual revolution. The pill had only been available for a half a dozen years, there was a lot of social change going on, and the campus was part of that. People, came from their experiences in other places, particularly urban areas, and brought those experiences and attitudes to campus. It was a tumultuous time because the administration and substantial part of the faculty and certainly the Board of Trustees had a very different worldview than a lot of the students. And, things that went on at the colleges were not that different from many other places around the country. Well, the Vietnam War was escalating. and people were upset about the Vietnam War. There was a lot of change. Remember the Civil Rights Act of 1964, followed by the Voting Rights Act of 1965, didn't come out of nowhere. They came out of the vigorous civil rights movement of the previous several years. And the atmosphere in the country was one of a mixture of conflict and hope. There was a lot of change going on at that time. In fact, my favorite professor, Joe DeGangi, a political science professor, I recall visiting with him decades later, and he saying that the most exciting time of his entire career were those years, 68, 69, 70. There was a lot going on.
That was certainly the air of the time. You know, what was going to happen next? Change was so incredibly fast.
Yeah, I think that it was a matter of them realizing that they had this agency and saying, okay, well, you know, we're certainly not happy with things large scale, but maybe we have this power to do things on a more local level. And they started really just shaking things up here at HWS. And a lot of things changed, like you said, in that 6 to 8 year period. You know, a lot of the processes and attitudes around coordinates started to, as we know them today, began to form when it became, you know, less of a Hobart and William Smith, but actually Hobart and William Smith colleges, where I like to think that there was sort of a bit more actual cohesion and not collusion so much as collaboration between the two colleges. You know, they were giving their diplomas to each other. They were getting rid of these outdated traditions. And, you know, I'd like to, this was around the point where I think people started, you know, walking on the grass if you were a first year. Like, this is about the time where I like to think that people put down the H book and started talking to people and, like, actually determining their own community standards.
Here is Maureen Collins-Zupan and Nancy Nurek Rutherford to describe what the changes at graduation look like for the classes of 1972.
And we, as a class, when we were getting ready to graduate, said that we wanted to do the program for graduation, for our commencement. And that, to his credit, the president at the time, President Kosciusko, said to us, instead of us boycotting commencement as we threatened to do, we could take over the programming, and we did. We sat together. There was a big chart on the quad. I think Roger Frankel was the person who always was organizing things, and there was a big chart, and you'd write your name where you were going to sit in the audience. The intention being that you would give the diploma to the next person. We had decided we had learned more from each other in those 4 years. And we wanted to award the diplomas to each other. So we decided where we'd sit. So it was Hobart and William Smith together. And when you walked up on the stage, you accepted your diploma from the person next to you, shook the hand, and turned and announced the name of the next person and awarded the diploma to them.
Kids that walked across the stage, they had their caps and gowns, but barefoot. One guy walked across with his dog. Most of us actually wore over our gowns a white armband to protest the war. So it was kind of just an evolving, heightening over those years of anti-war and anti-establishment sentiment.
We did our own music. The Beatles' Hey Jude, I think we marched into. And Buffalo Springfield, For What It's Worth, Moving Out, which is a great song about activism. It's a great, great song. We had the first student speaker, John Barron, and we make John at every one of our reunions do his speech again. We make him get up and give the speech again because we all loved it so much. B.F. Skinner was our speaker, and he was horrible, as I remember. He was just horrible. But it was, so much had changed. All these rules and traditions, etc., had gone away by the time we graduated.
One of the final things to come out of this is, well, Tommy. No one knows what really happened to him after this. He was charged with defrauding the state due to his unemployment benefits and was given 1 year probation. He ended up getting another job as a police officer later before opening his own horse ranch in the Midwest. In a 1975 interview, Tommy said, quote, "The whole thing was crazy, but I can't say I regret it. I was serving my country. They called me a provocateur. They said I was giving bombs to innocent kids, showing them how to use guns. You don't understand it, but that's the art of the undercover psychology. I showed people how a bomb would go off, but I never handled explosives that the radicals could have got hold of." End quote. Not everyone agrees with that characterization, though. Here is a final word from the 1971 documentary, The Revolutionary Was a Cop, given by its director, Mark Weiss.
"My name is Mark Weiss, and I made this film. I'm coming on camera like this to accuse Thomas Tomei, alias Tommy the Traveler, of being a provocateur, a conspirator, and participant in criminal activities. Thomas Tomei was a paid deputy of the Sheriff of Ontario County, New York, for a period of more than 2 months. He was recommended for the job by a high government investigative agency, probably the FBI. For more than 2 years before that, Tommy traveled to at least 15 campuses in upstate New York, posing as a super-militant organizer for SDS. There is evidence that during at least a part of this time, Tommy was a paid informer for the Federal Bureau of Investigation. I think no one who has seen this film and heard the testimony of these witnesses can doubt that Tongyai was a provocateur. Consider these facts. First, that Tommy often flourished hand grenades and guns, attempting to persuade students to use them for so-called revolutionary purposes. Second, that Tommy consistently urged reluctant students to adopt violent tactics such as kidnapping a congressman, killing policemen, and vandalizing property. Third, that Tommy sought to guide students in manufacturing use of explosives and that he offered to test the final product. Fourth, that Tommy did in fact demonstrate the detonation of various explosives, especially black powder devices. He frequently suggested that such explosives be used on dormitories and houses and meetings. When students rejected these overtures, he pressed them to direct bombing efforts against other structures or out of doors. Fifth, that Tommy, while an agent of a local police agency, did in fact succeed in provoking the firebombing of the Hobart ROTC offices, endangering the lives of students. Under New York State law, these acts are classified as conspiracy to commit arson, criminal solicitation, reckless endangerment, criminal facilitation, and entrapment. In addition, it is a violation of federal law to use or attempt to use explosives against academic structures. The secret police agent is not above the law. He is responsible for his crimes fully as much as those whom he polices. In American society, there is no such thing as a privileged lawbreaker. So this question remains. Why did the grand jury, in its investigation of the activities of Tommy the Traveler, overlook the information that was easily available to it, the testimony of the witnesses that has been presented here? Why was Tommy never indicted for any of his crimes?"
We tried getting in contact with Tommy for this miniseries. We called the phone number listed for him online and tried the horse ranch he owns out in the Midwest. However, we were unsuccessful. Instead, we have his words from interviews and the testimonies of the 21 people we personally interviewed and those in the documentary. But there is no final word from Thomas Tongyai, also known as Tommy the Traveler.
As much as this is, you know, a story about a rogue FBI agent, like, and it's just so much irresponsibility. It's also a story about competing visions for not only the colleges, but for the United States.
And I'd say the reason why it matters is because those, it, with this story, I think the absurdity alone merits the coverage.
Coming off of this, or really any story like this, it's an opportunity to just think about what we want to change, or what we want to stay the same, and like what we want to be remembered for. Because I'm sure the class of 1972 did not want to be remembered for a giant drug raid and a firebombing and all this stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, as students at this college, that's something to think about, is legacy.
It raises the question of what the subsequent classes are going to say about us, what our legacy is. You know, we determine it every day, not just in our thoughts and actions, but by the events that take place on campus and how we react to them. And I think we can look at Tommy as a very good sort of example of a catalyst gone completely awry, where this is a outside body that's not bringing about any sort of actual change, or, you know, even beneficial, anything beneficial.
Shortly after we arrived, you know, we began to be aware. Now, remember, that summer was Woodstock. It was Man on the Moon. There was a lot of stuff that happened just before we arrived. That was pretty significant.
And I think the bombing at ROTC, the ROTC office, and then the drug bust and the trials and everything, it took away any illusions that we might have had about, you know, you can idealistically protest the war and somehow it's going to end. And of course it didn't end for a long time. But it was a very strange time.
This took place in the context of many of the changes and upheavals in the 60s, some of them positive and very kind of liberating, and elation, gave way to elation and ecstatic vision and sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And then there was this crazy political scene where Nixon was in charge, and didn't seem like we'd ever get the war ended. And things would swing back and forth. But I'd say that it had sort of a traumatic effect, where the rest of the experience was in some way anticlimax to that, but in a way where you would perhaps wish that you could get back to some kind of stability or balance, but I don't think it was ever really achieved, not during the time I was there. I'm talking about as a community or as a nation.
Geneva is a very resilient city. We've had, as far back as you want to go, good times and not so good times. But they've survived it and now are much stronger. They're also a very giving community. I think very few people realize the amount of donations people are making, not just of their money, but of their time to help other people. And that's not just recently, that's been as long as I've been around the community.
We all had this very traumatic event in common. Not a day went by that you didn't think about it in some form or fashion. And I think it also justified a lot of the anti-war distrust of government, distrust of the police sentiment that a lot of students had. I mean, after this, it certainly did nothing to improve the students' relationships with the authorities. It couldn't.
It was a scary time. A lot of people think the 60s were fun and games and, you know, love and sex and drugs. And it was actually pretty scary. It's funny how nobody knows about him on campus anymore. I've talked to a lot of other graduates, and, you know, they didn't know that all this stuff happened. We were really we were really super involved. Now, I don't know where the guy came from or why he was there to incite everybody to do all this stuff, which I found out the night of the drug bust. I didn't have any idea, because before that we were just doing our normal protest stuff and going to classes, trying to be normal at the same time. But the night of the drug bust, it was when it all became clear to me.
That was Henry Lenz, Joanne Dunn, Joe Curley, Walter Gage, Steve Bromberg, and Shirley Napolitano Banker.
We have a long history here at the colleges, and it's one that, you know, starts at two different points. So I think that this is one story, an incredible one, but one story out of an institution where people feel so almost immersed and overwhelmed by the actual nature of the institution, because we like to talk about, you know, lives of consequence and the sort of generations that that's been built upon, but sometimes that's a lot to take in. It's a lot to take in all of this and internalize it, but even more so to make meaning from it.
I also think that on campus today, there's a certain level of just sort of apathy and, you know, disengagement from the students in their setting.
The times that we went through with the huge changes from coming on as 18-year-old high school students to 22-year-olds who had marched to Washington and changed, you know, all kinds of things. I'm very proud of who we were, who we are, and what we went through. I think is a big reason that as a class, we mean a lot to each other, even if we don't see each other for a long time. We mean a lot to each other.
It's proven what Tommy was up to, and I'm very glad that you're looking at this small piece of relatively unimportant upstate New York history, because it has a lot to say about our government and the times and the past and future of free speech in the United States.
One thing I learned at Hobart was not to stay silent. That if you feel strongly enough about something, you have to speak up. I said, I'm not throwing firebombs, but I'm saying what I believe. So I definitely got a very good education in critical thinking. And then in my career, I got to work with real professional journalists. And, you know, and it really helped me hone my approach to all of this.
You don't think of things like this until something like this comes out. Is from 66 to 70, I think the campus probably underwent some of the most dramatic changes in its history. And maybe, again, I'm parochial in my opinion, but the classes you took, what you had to take, how the whole social culture, the, you know, no girls in dorm rooms and drinking and drugs and all that was somewhat in its infancy or somewhat limited for your freshman year. And by the time you left 4 years later, there were discussions on, you know, what courses, just the whole social unrest. It went sort of from the Ward Cleaver, Leave It to Beaver age to the, you know, just a whole different world almost by 70. And you saw that in microcosm, I thought, on the campus. And I don't know if other four-year periods have undergone such what I would call dramatic change.
That was Dan Watkins, Maureen Collins-Zupan, Henry Lenz, and John Hennessy.
Russell and Henry, thank you both for your incredible work on this. It has been great to work with you on this project, to hear all of your insights and your research into this incredible time period, and none of this would have been really possible without the two of you
spending hours in the archives and just being committed to this kind of work. So thank you so much.
And thank you to Thanks. Our fearless leader. We couldn't have done it without you. Never would have gotten off the ground.
So before we sign off, on our mini-series on Tommy the Traveler and campus unrest in the 1960s and 1970s, we want to quickly let you all hear from the people that we have talked to, the 21 people who were on this show. They're all going to have a chance to quickly say their names, class years, and occupations.
Walter Gage, graduated from Hobart in 1962, and I've been an attorney since 1965 when I came back from graduate school. Retired city judge.
Maureen Collins Zupan, class of 1972, and I am happily retired.
Daniel Watkins, also the class of 2, and also very happily retired.
My name is Richard Wasserman, Hobart class of 70, and I'm an allergist immunologist.
Bill Ryder, class of 1971, I'm a retired healthcare lawyer, lobbyist.
My name is Tim Yolen, Hobart William Smith, class of 72. My occupation is attorney at law.
My name is Shirley Banker. My maiden name at Hobart and William Smith was Shirley Napolitano, 72. I'm retired.
Bill Banker, class of 70, and I'm a retired news editor.
Yeah, my name is Bruce Davis. I'm a psychologist. I was in the class of 1972.
Andy Wickenden, class of 2009. I am a freelance writer, technically, but more or less on the staff of the HWS Communications Office.
John Hennessy, class of 70, now retired.
So I am Joanne Lyons Dunn, class of 1973, and I'm a nonprofit association executive.
Oh, name Stephen Bromberg, class year 1972, and I'm a news journalist, or was for most of my career. Now I'm a ghostwriter, but spent most of my career as a news journalist.
Okay, Henry Lenz, class of 1972, and I was a sound engineer and a technical director for CBS News from 1973 to 2012. And now I'm retired and I live in Los Angeles.
My name is Mark Weiss, graduated in 1969. My occupation has changed. I worked in media for 40 years after graduating in independent documentaries and internet. But for the last 8 years, I've been working full-time on climate organizing.
My name is Nancy Nowak Rutherford. I was in the class of 1971. After I graduated from William Smith, I taught junior high English for 18 years, and then I stayed home with my family after that.
My name is George Michael Drozdowicz. Hobart class of 1972, and I am an attorney.
So my name's Jim Sterling, and I was a freshman in 1969. I actually graduated in 1974 because I took some time off, but I would have been the class of 73.
My name is Joseph DeGangi. I came to the colleges in 1967. And was there for 30 years, retired in 1997, and I taught in the political science department the American division of the poli-sci, focusing primarily on judicial behavior and constitutional law and various other topics in American politics.
I'm Pat McGuire, currently interim president, but I arrived in the fall of 1968 to the economics department. I taught in the department and I retired in 2010, and that was 45 years. I tried to escape, but they found me and continued to keep finding me. No, I've been in the community, and my wife Sandy and I decided to stay, and we've been very much part of the local community, and I have had no problems coming back to the college. It's a great place.
Those were the 21 people we spoke with and interviewed for this podcast series. We are incredibly grateful to them for their time and sharing their recollections with us. It is such an incredible story and part of the history of Hobart and William Smith Colleges. 49 years later, we at the Herald and Seneca Scene are proud to bring the story to you through this podcast miniseries. We hope it has been interesting, thought-provoking, and informative. That was episode 10, The End, concluding the Seneca Scene's miniseries on Tommy the Traveler and campus unrest at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. Thank you for tuning in to the Seneca Scene. You can subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts or on the Herald website by going to hwsherald.com/podcast. This episode series was created by Alex Karai and Albright DeWorka. Our team on this series is Grace Rubel, Russell Payne, Henry Dewar, Albright DeWorka, and Alex Karai. Our show is produced by Alex Karai. This series was written by Alex Karai, Grace Rubel, and Russell Payne. Our show is hosted by Alex Karai with Russell Payne and Henry Dewar. Archival research was done by Russell Payne and Henry Dewar. Additional research by Grace Rubel. Additional materials were provided by Henry Lenz from the class of 1972, members of the Classes of 1972 or Thereabouts Facebook group, Andrew Wickenden from the class of 2009, and Professor Ani Mukherjee. Interviews were conducted and recorded by Alex Karai. Interviews compiled by Henry Dewar and Russell Payne. Video materials compiled by Albright DeWorka. Our thanks to the guests that appeared on this episode. This episode was edited by Albright DeWorka. Sound engineering and podcast recording by Alex Karai in the WEOS studio at the Scanlon Campus Center of Hobart and William Smith Colleges. Our partners at WEOS are Kelly Walker and Greg Cotterill. Music composed by Alex Karai. This show is funded by an Elliott Grant from Hobart and William Smith Colleges. Our thanks to four fantastic HWS alums: Maureen Collins-Zupan from the class of 1972, Henry Lenz from the class of 1972, Andrew Wickenden from the class of 2009, and Susan Hess from the class of 1985 for their help and guidance. This show is a production of The Herald, the campus newspaper of Hobart and William Smith Colleges. From the campus of Hobart and William Smith Colleges, this has been the Seneca Scene. I'm Alex Karai.
I'm Henry Dewar.
I'm Russell Payne.
And this has been the Seneca Scene special miniseries on Tommy the Traveler. We hope you will join us next time for our regular episodes, which consist of interviews with faculty, staff, and students at HWS. From the campus of Hobart and William Smith Colleges, I'm Alex Karai. Thank you for listening to the Seneca Scene.